Brethren, we left off talking on Revelation 17 and verse 11. We had talked in the previous couple of verses about the mystery that the mind, Revelation 17, 9, that the mind which hath wisdom is going to be given information. And we talked about how that was the mind of the new creature, spirit enlightened, that would be able to grasp this, the intriguing and intricate symbology of the symbols in the following verses. And it certainly, one doesn't want to be dogmatic on the interpretations, but there's some good suggestions that we try to grasp. Different brethren have offered different suggestions over the years, and we offer ours, and it's just a matter of each one just making it their own, but at least having exposed to a concept. And I'm going to repeat a little bit. So I'd like Sister Alice, could you read for us in Revelation 17, 9 through 13, 9 through 13.
You hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Revelation 17, 9. And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which a woman sitteth. And there are seven kings, five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition. And the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings which have received no kingdom as yet, but received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. Wait, okay. How far?
That was it. Thank you.
Okay.
Did you have any opening comment?
only I was reading the King James. And I think in verse 12, that receive no power as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour. I think that that's spurious or something.
The as yet, those two words are spurious, yeah.
Okay.
Even though it doesn't change a lot as far as understanding goes, but it is good to know. Okay. Very good. So, brethren, the part of that the mind that hath wisdom, the Revelator writes that the seven heads, which we've seen on the beast, which we saw on the great red dragon back in the 12th chapter, are seven mountains. And we know that mountains represent kingdoms. Kingdoms are a form of government. And it says that these are which the woman sitteth. So that's the challenge. Now, we've identified the woman as being particularly the harlot woman in this chapter as being the religious aspect of the papacy predominantly. That she's the harlot. That she had an illicit relationship with the kings of earth. She had an illicit relationship with these seven mountains, if you will, these seven kingdoms. There was some manner in which she was in existence at some level and had at some more or less influence as a religious entity. Particularly. But the peculiar part is that in verse 1, It shows us the woman, the harlot woman, sits upon many waters. So she sits on the waters. It's not saying she's sitting on a mountain there. But in verse 3, we read that the John class is carried away in spirit into the wilderness. That's taking us back in time to that period when there was a church-state government. We call it the fourth head. But the woman is sitting on a scarlet-colored beast, names full of blasphemy. So now we have the woman on a beast, or she is supported by the Roman Empire. And so she doesn't need to be just supported by the waters. She's now sitting on the beast. Okay. In verse 15, and he saith unto me, the waters which you saw, well, that is back in the first verse, where the harlot sits, back in the first verse, are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. So that's interpreting the symbol of the waters in this chapter. It's not interpreting the symbol of waters wherever waters appear throughout the Bible, but it is interpreting it in this chapter because it says so. And this is why we say the woman, the harlot woman, the religious aspect of papacy has always been supported by the people who are Roman Catholic. Catholics support the Roman aspect of papacy, the religious aspect of papacy. And when she sits on the beast, when she has a leading role in the government of the beast, the Roman Empire, which would be a church-state form of government, the people still support her. But the people are pictured as the body of the beast. You know, a beast has a body. The body has a head. And on the head are the horns. That's how animals are in the Bible. So the head is where the brains are. So it does the controlling. So the heads are the governments that control the people, the body of the empire. And the horns are on the heads. And the horns are lesser powers, kings and princes that support the empire. So what we see is that Revelation 17 has separated the woman from the beast to show us that as a religious entity, the papacy has been supported by Roman Catholic people during this gospel age, since her beginning. And they continue to do so. But there are times when she has a more prominent role in governing in the empire. And we call those a church and state form of government. And when that takes place, she's riding the beast. That's how she's shown as being supported by the people. They're the body of the beast. Is that making sense? Okay. So what we're saying then is that when we get to this verse 9, the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth, we're recognizing that we're suggesting that this is an accommodated expression, because we just saw that the woman is not always in control of the government. She's not always on the beast. Sometimes she sits on the waters. So in what way she sits on these seven mountains, these seven heads, seven forms of government, we're suggesting is that she was in existence and had some influence more or less. And we tried to give some examples last week that how that could be. Now, let's turn to Revelation 12. Again, this is kind of repeating from last week, but bear with us. In Revelation 12, we had read the opening verses And we want to reread these. I know it's a big repeat, but let's just for clarity. Let's see, Brother Adi, could you read Revelation 12, 1 through 6?
A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on its head. Its tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that it might devour her child the moment he was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child who will rule the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the wilderness into a place prepared for her by God where she might be taken care of for 1260 days.
Okay. All right. Very good. So, opening comment, Brother Adi, on this at all?
So this is, when the church, the papacy, is about to be born, and the governments were cautious about it, but she was brought up to, she was snatched up to God, meaning that she had a position of religious authority. And the woman, the true woman, the church had to flee into the wilderness to be protected against the papacy. Over.
Very good. Thank you. Very good. So, in this, the reason we wanted to come back to this is you and I are asking ourselves, when do we start counting these 7 heads with the woman? When do we start counting which 7 governments over the Roman Empire? Because the Roman Empire goes way back, way back. Long before Christianity, because it was a pagan empire in great power controlling over Israel when our Lord was born. So we ask ourselves, when do we start counting these 7 heads? And this chapter, I think, is part of the answer to that question for us. And it's because this chapter starts with the true church, the pure element of the church beginning in 33 AD. 33 AD at Pentecost, when the church became spirit begotten. That's this woman in verse 1. She's got the New Testament sun for her clothing. The law and the prophets are the moon that she's supported by. And she has a crown of the 12 stars. The 12 apostles are her guiding lights, the starlights. And yet she is pregnant, which doesn't really make sense because she's supposed to be a virgin woman, the early church. But she is pregnant. And you will remember that we take the 280 days of the gestation period of a baby, 280 days. We add it to 33 AD and it brings us to 313 AD. And that brings us to Constantine. And Constantine was the first Roman emperor to accept Christianity, nominally. And then he gained control over the empire. And by 325, 313 to 325, he holds a great council of Nicaea to try to settle the raging debate between Arius and Athanasius. Is Jesus of the same substance of God, making him co-eternal? Arius said no. Athanasius said yes. This is the great division that Constantine set as a religious position with the first of the great church councils, which Brother Russell observed the church councils started to replace true Bible study. And that led to all the creed making thereafter. So this was our setting, and we've got a dragon here with seven heads and 10 horns. And it's demonstrating to us that we need to include this Constantine, the Roman emperor who became a nominal Christian. That's our first head. This is where we would start counting our seven heads. And the pregnant woman gives birth, and this man-child who will become the man of sin as he develops comes forth and demonstrates, it's demonstrating to us that the influence of the Bishop of Rome and the nominal church already was starting to be felt as early as Constantine's rule. So the woman is, in an accommodated sense, pictured as sitting on the government or with it, even though she is not a, it's not a church state government in the fullest sense, because the papacy hasn't fully developed yet. So, that's why we came here to look at these verses to help give us a starting point. Because this great red dragon had seven heads and 10 horns, it's identifying it as the Roman Empire. And so we think this is, in the book of Revelation, this is where we start counting what seven forms of government we're interested in. So, Sister Debbie, I did talk through your raised hand. Did you have a comment you'd like to make?
Well, I just wanted to bring out 1 John 2:18, where John says, even now Antichrist have become many, once we know that is the last hour, so that even in John's day, Antichrist was, you know, raising its little head, trying to cause havoc. But it couldn't, because John was still there, the apostle was still there to make the corrections. Over.
Okay, so there was a spirit of Antichrist, even in the days of the apostles. And let's make a connecting link. In 2 Thessalonians 2, and Brother David Vickery, could you read that for us, please? 2 Thessalonians 2, and let's read 3-7.
Second Thessalonians 2:3-7. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there be a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he is God, sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Remember ye not that when I was yet with you, I told you these things, and now ye know what withholdeth, that he might be revealed in his time. For the mystery of iniquity doth already work. Only he who now letteth will let, until he be taken out of the way. And this is, works right into what you're saying, Brother Rick, and that the deceptions of the Antichrist system are already at work. and that the man of sin will be revealed before the deliverance comes, and that the kingdom of Rome has to, and the infrastructure of Rome, before they move to Constantinople, was instrumental in setting up the Romish Church. So once the Roman government moved out, the religious system moved in. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Oh, we appreciate that. Very good. Very good. This King James is pretty lousy on these verses. What does the word letteth actually mean? What's a better understanding? Sister Debbie?
Well, the Youngs called it, where is it? He who is keeping down now will hinder until he may be out of the way. So it's a matter of keeping it down, you know, that it can't come out of the abyss.
True. Well, not out of the abyss, but that's, but the thought of keeping it down, yes. Sister Connie.
This version here says restraineth.
Okay, good. Restraineth. Yep. Sister Cheryl?
Yes, I have hinder, but Diaglot says restraining.
Okay, very good. So the ambitions of the Antichrist spirit couldn't grow and develop the way it wanted to because the Roman Empire was standing in the way, and they were pagans. So a Christian church isn't going to have much success in gaining power over the empire if the empire is pagan. But when Constantine adopted Christianity, well, now that just opened the door. So now you can have this spirit of Antichrist. It can breed and grow and expand into the Roman Empire into a position of authority because Constantine opened the door for Christians to have power and authority by claiming to be a Christian himself. So these verses, Paul has prophetically brought out when the mystery of iniquity highlighted in papacy, the man of sin, 2 Thessalonians 2:3, man of sin, that is our man child that was born back in Revelation 12:5. Here's a man of sin, and there it's called the man child. The man child grows and develops. Here, the man of sin starts to likewise acquire great authority and presents himself as if he's God's representative in God's temple, which is the church. So this is the nominal perspective, the nominal church perspective, that when Constantine adopted Christianity, nominal Christians think that's the greatest thing that ever happened. Because the persecution by the pagans of Christians stopped. But it allowed the nominal spirit of Christianity to grow exponentially. So taking all this back then to Revelation 12, the 12:5, the man child came forth who was to rule. In other words, a future event. All the nations with a rod of iron and was caught up unto God and to his throne. This is a depiction of the counterfeit, millennium, the counterfeit of the true kingdom. So, in our verse 6, Brother Adi read, the woman fled into the wilderness. That's our 1260 years, starting in 539 AD, as we know. And then verse 7, which we didn't read, and there was war in heaven. Michael, the counterfeit Michael, the popes, and his angels, all the bishops and archbishops and priests and clergy, fought against the dragon, the civil authority. And the dragon fought with his angels. The civil authorities, they have their retinue of officials. But in verse 8, the dragon prevailed not. Neither was their place found any more in heaven. That is, as a religious authority, the Roman emperors lost their position. So, when we studied through this, we saw that in this Revelation 12, we saw the development of the nominal church system develop exponentially after Constantine adopted Christianity. And then, by 800 AD, the Pope was crowning Charlemagne, Charles the Great. The Pope was crowning Charlemagne to be the emperor of the Roman Empire, And from 800 to 1799, we have our 1,000-year counterfeit millennium of the so-called Holy Roman Empire. So, brother, we looked at all this, and now we can have a greater confidence of when to start counting the seven heads. We also see that papacy, as an Antichrist influence, was there on the scene when Constantine came into power, adopting Christianity over the empire. So we're saying, in this accommodated sense, the papacy, this woman, sits on the heads in that she has a relevance of influence. But specifically, she's depicted as riding the beast. She's riding the beast when it's a church-state government and she has more direct control. And the beast denotes a church and state form of government. Now, I had mentioned last week again about the, as far as our heads, seven heads list, we had talked about the fall of Constantine the Great, and then the Western Empire concluding in 476 AD. That was head number one. Then we had number two, the Goths, including the various different tribes that came into power from 476 AD to 527 AD. And then Justinian the First continued 527 AD to 800 AD. Then had four, Charlemagne, the Papal Roman Empire, counterfeit millennium, 800 to 1799. But in I just want to read a little, quick little blurb out of this magazine called The Romans. Again, this is, it's about the whole Roman Empire, but I just zeroed in about the fall of the Roman Empire at the end. And there's just one little blurb I want to read out of here regarding even a little bit of papal influence, this woman sitting on the seven heads, even with these Goths. So just jumping in the middle of this sentence for time's sake. In the 5th century, or in the 400s, the Huns began direct attacks on the Western Empire, that is the Western Empire, Rome. In 455 AD, the Vandals, a Germanic people who had migrated to North Africa, set up an independent kingdom earlier, sacked Rome again. The Vandals spent 2 weeks pillaging, but were persuaded not to burn the city of Rome when Pope Leo I intervened. So this little blurb is just, again, a suggestion how the woman sits on these seven mountains. The papacy had some influence throughout the period of time from Constantine all the way down to the last head. She's had influence, but she's only riding on the beast form of government or the beast head during the fourth form, that Holy Roman Empire period, as well as we think the eighth, which is a return form of head. So that's really it. There's no sense to keep reading more out of that, but I just thought that was just a quick little blurb that would show that even when the Goths were there, the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, still was having some level of influence. But I kind of have to leave it at that. It's like I say, these are suggestions, and each one should be, content in their own minds. And sometimes these are things that you just, if you don't feel comfortable with it, you just set it on the shelves, as Bible students are fond of saying, and can just continue to move forward in your studies, and maybe something comes to light that clarifies it one way or the other for each of us. So with that, is there any other comment on that angle of verse 17:9? Okay. So I know that's because no one's saying anything doesn't mean you're accepting it. That's fine. It's just we're leaving it there. Verse 10, and there are seven kings, five are fallen, one is, the other's not yet come, and when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And we've discussed this. We've got our list of heads. We feel Napoleon is the fifth head, and then followed by Victor Emmanuel II and his descendants, then followed by the seventh head, the fascist Nazi regime, 1925 to 1945. And that we zeroed in on that sixth head. See, that's the one that is during the time setting of this chapter, when the woman is sitting on the waters and one of the seven angels had come to her, came to the John class and explained about the papacy's history. And that was Brother Russell's writings, explained the papacy's history to us. And so Brother Russell's writings took place during Victor Emmanuel II and his descendants' period of their reign, up until the fascists. So it helps make a connecting link for us. And in verse 11, the beast that was and is not even, he's the eighth, and is of the seven and goes into destruction. And we've suggested here again, this is an eighth head. I know that's debated. Some don't feel that they think it's an eighth beast, but a headless beast. I'll talk on that in a minute. And, but it's of the seven, which seems to us the seven what? Not the seven beasts. It's the seven heads. So if the eighth is of the seven heads, it's a form of government. And so being of the seven, that's where we suggest it's a repeat of one of the previous forms of government. And that's the repeat of the church and state. And the reason we feel it's a repeat of the church and state is because in verse 12, the 10 horns, which you saw are 10 kings, 10 powers, they have not received kingdom, but will receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. So this would show a church and state arrangement, we believe. If it was purely civil, it would be a dragon. But it's not a dragon. It's a beast. So that's that church and state arrangement. And you notice in verse 13, these have one mind. Well, the mind is the brain, and that's in a head. So they have one mind. They are giving their power to one mind, one brain, one head, where the brain is. And what does it do? In verse 14, these shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb overcomes them. So in our discussion, we've covered most of this, but I said last week that some of the brethren refer to a quote by Brother Russell, who makes a comment that this eighth is a headless beast. And last week we had stated that to us a headless beast is a dead beast. Because if you cut off the head on a beast, it can't live. There's no head. And there's no place for the horns. Because the horns on an animal are always on the head. But nonetheless, I wanted to touch on that because that's an important point to consider, because we all appreciate the harvest message. So part of it goes back to harvest gleanings number one. Harvest gleanings number one, and you'll find it first mentioned on page 20 and page 21. Harvest Gleanings, Volume 1, page 20 and 21. But please note that this is in the book Three Worlds. Three Worlds. And Three Worlds was predominantly written by Barber. Predominantly written by Barber. Brother Russell contributed, but it's predominantly written by Barber. And I'm going to give you a reprint to demonstrate that. It's reprint 3822. 3822. Brother Russell states that the Three Worlds was written primarily by Barber. You remember Barber gave up on the ransom and left the truth. And that's why one of the reasons why Brother Russell wrote Tabernacle Shadows in 1881 was to defend the ransom against Barber's attacks. Remember, he was the fellow with the Christ's blood no more efficacious than a fly stuck on the head of a pin. So we take this book, The Three Worlds, which Brother Russell stopped printing. He stopped printing it. He replaced it. There was A Day Dawn, which was written by Patton. And then lo and behold, Patton follows after Barber. And finally, Brother Russell writes the first volume, Tabernacle Shadows, 1881, first volume, 1886. Brother Russell was trying to respect these others who were older than him. You know, Barber and Patton were older, and he was trying to cooperate until he just had to disassociate himself. And the readers of the Watchtower, he had to assist them to learn to disassociate from these influences. So it's here on these two pages that you read about some of this aspect. And you know, when you read it, some of it's really good and some of it's not so good. You could see how the brethren over the years have adopted parts of it and sifted out the parts that weren't so good. But through it all, each one has to, again, figure it out for themselves. So on page 20, in one place, he writes, While the international or republican element represents the body of the beast or the peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues on which the woman sat, and this third of the empire, when fully developed, is to be a headless monster or the beast after its last head is fallen, Revelation 17:11. Just what the commune or internationals profess to be. So they call it, the commune was a revolutionary form of government during the French Revolution, for example. Robespierre and the others. But nonetheless, here's where we find this first expression of a headless beast. And it's in this book. Now, like I said, you can read it and you can find some things that are good, some things that are not so good. But then the one place I'm familiar of, which you'll find it in the expanded comments, from a reprint, it's reprint 2062. Reprint 2062. Again, you can find that right in the expanded comments. This is an article that's one of the views from the tower, where it's kind of a conglomeration of various thoughts that Brother Russell was having at the time of the printing of this watchtower. This was 1896. This is a watchtower from the year 1896. So relatively early. And you can tell by that number, 2062. So he's at the end of the second column on that page. As he's going down, he picks up on a new subheading. The New York Tribune of November 5th says editorially, and for more than a quarter of a century, the Catholics in Italy have been debarred by order of the church from taking any part in parliamentary elections. And then it goes on. And he writes for four paragraphs, but that's what he's writing about this current event in 1896, what's going on in Italy. But our point of interest is to second to last paragraph in that second column. To our understanding, the present Italian government is the seventh head of the beast, Revelation 17:9 through 11, which has continued a short space, represented in the present monarch and his father, Victor Emmanuel. Accordingly to this prophecy, Rome will never have another head. The eighth condition will be the beast without a head, either a republic or anarchy. If a republic, we shall shortly expect anarchy, destruction. All the signs of our time corroborate prophecy and bid us to lift up our heads and rejoice that our redemption is not. So just to understand this, Brother Russell thought that the Victor Emmanuel kingdom, if you will, was the seventh head. Well, we make it the sixth head, because the fascists and the Nazis controlled the Roman Empire after Victor Emmanuel dynasty passed away. And we think that Brother Russell is not trying to interpret this entire 17th chapter harmoniously. He's commenting on a couple of verses and trying to apply it to the current event of his day in 1896. Because you and I have determined that the setting for the 17th chapter is in the sixth head. verse 10, there are seven kings. Five are fallen, that is past. One is, that's the current head, that's number six. And one is yet to come. That's the seventh. So that's what we're really, so we have to already start to accommodate Brother Russell's comment here. He was thinking things were going to wind down quickly. That's why he says, we see things are wrapping up, so we lift up our heads and rejoice. However, he just uses this comment about a headless beast, and I think the only other place I've seen it is going back to that Harvest Gleanings, the Three Worlds comment that was written primarily by Barber. So he doesn't offer more of an explanation on how to incorporate what a headless beast would mean. And he doesn't really answer the question how the eighth is of the seven, because it's seven heads. So as the eighth is of the seven and it's seven heads, then the eighth should be another head. It's just a repeat head. There's nothing there that says it should be a headless beast, the way I read it. So a lot of brethren, you know, they've harmonized it as being a headless beast and a revolutionary form of government. I don't know how that fits in with Brother Russell's view of church and state as being the final power by which the church will give their final witness, as we've read in all these previous chapters in Revelation, how we've read in Brother Russell's writings in the fourth volume in 1916, he was looking for a church state power to come into existence after the war. And so I don't know how a headless beast fits into a church state form of government that he was expecting. This is just a passing comment that he made early on in 1896, never got back to it. And as he said, he was going to write on Revelation, but even on his deathbed, he told Brother, his personal secretary, I don't want to mess up the name, told him that someone else is going to have to write on the Revelation. Because he recognized that was not going to be his lot. So, okay. So he didn't write harmoniously, trying to harmonize the entire book. So we take where it's good. We think it's harmonious. And then we just have to leave that which might not make sense to us. And, but everyone has to sort it out. So. But I wanted to touch on it to try to give it a fair shake. You can have if you weren't familiar with those references, you can look at them at your leisure. But is there any comment now on all of this so far? Or any questions? Okay, Brother Dan.
Well, I don't know if this is a good question, but what would be the appeal of a headless beast? Why do some like that thought? Because as you brought out, when you just think practically on it, if you cut the head off of a beast, it can't live. And also, in connection with what we're reading in Revelation, the 17th chapter, there's no indication that the beast wouldn't have a head, just as brought out. It's a repeat of the seven. It's the, you know, it's the fourth beast. So I'm just not, I don't know, because I've never really heard anyone discuss this thought of the headless beast. Over.
Yes, well, a lot of fine brethren hold that view, probably a majority, if you will. I think a lot of it goes back to where we had studied in Revelation 11 about what what form of government was persecuting the Bible. Like we discussed there, the one possibility that we favored was the papacy was persecuting the Bible in the 1500s, and then the Bible emerged victorious, came out of the dead languages. But some view that, and for good, you know, for their logical reasons, they view that as the French Revolution form of government. And so the French Revolution form of government, they had rejected the Bible in the big cities for a period of time. But they feel that's a revolutionary government. Part of my problem is a revolutionary government is still a government, which means it's still ahead. Robespierre had been ahead, part of the Commune, and then he was guillotined, and then he was replaced, though, by other leaders, men who were leaders of the Commune form of government. They were making laws. They were passing laws. They changed the work week from 7 days to 10 days and many other things. So it's not the absence of a government. A revolutionary government is still a government, and a government's ahead. So I really didn't, to my mind, it doesn't really fit that way for me. As far as in this reprint where Brother Russell says it's possibly anarchy, well, anarchy, that's true. There is no head in anarchy. There is no government in anarchy. But the anarchy doesn't come till after the church-state government has been judged down by the seven last plagues, and the people then reject it, that form of government. Then comes your anarchy after that. So anyway, I guess I will leave it there at that. Sister Debbie?
Yeah, I was wondering, these governments, you said the headless would be more like a republic ruled by the people. And I'm wondering if these governments have to be in Europe or if they are, in a sense, rulers of the known world at the time. Because the U.S., I guess, could be considered a headless beast that's ruling, you know, because it's ruled by the people, supposedly, but and laws are made for the people, by the people, kind of thing. And the U.S. is kind of like ruling over the world, the known world as we kind of know it. I wonder if that has any bearing, or if it has to be in Europe or where Rome ruled over.
Well, it's the Roman Empire is what we're talking about for sure. But the United States and Canada, and they become included as part of that by extension as the colonies. But the real key is that the United States has a form of government. We're not a revolutionary government. We have a form of government. So to my mind, that's ahead. There's laws and there's order and such. So for what it's worth, Brother Adi.
So the King or the NIV translates verse 13 as they have one purpose and will give their power and authority. And my thought is, I mean, the Republic of the United States is never really had one purpose. Yeah, you can see the divisions and the difficulty in passing laws and doing what's the right thing to do. The form of governments that have one purpose are autocracies, monarchs, and dictatorship, because that is one head that guides and makes the decisions over.
Well, there's truth to that, and you all will remember, because we visited it a few times, not in the distant past. In the second volume, you'll remember, Brother Russell states he wouldn't be surprised of a monarchy happening in this very country of the United States of America in the future. So that would go along with Brother Adi's comment. That's the church and state that we're looking forward to that will enforce the marking of the beast and its image. All right, Sister Carrie.
I'm thinking, I keep, every time I hear of this scenario discussed about the headless beast and the reoccurrence of the seventh, and it's the eighth. It's like, if fascism and Nazi parties, their head is gone, their heads are gone, however they keep them reemerging in no particular country, but the mindset resumes and it's getting stronger and it's sort of a headless thing. And then it seems like the Christian nationalists could be they have a very similar agenda. And when they're starting to blend a little bit, like they mingle and cooperate. And I don't get any special headlines on my phone. I don't filter. I'm not a news reader. I'm just looking at the regular stuff my phone provides. And you see stuff about neo-Nazis and Christian nationalists and like the CPAC meetings. They didn't ask the Nazis to leave this last one. And I don't know. Maybe I'm the wrong person to raise my hand on this, but I'm going to stop there.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, we are in tumultuous times for sure. It's nice to belong to a heavenly country and just be ambassadors. Thank you. Brother Michael.
Just a question. I know the focus right now for Revelation is primarily the church, but where does Israel come in all of this conversation?
There's not much on Israel in the Revelation. That's true. So, the Israel role in the Revelation, as best I can tell, is when the New Jerusalem is established. And Israel plays a role in the New Covenant arrangement. We talk about that in Revelation 21 but as far as Israel's role, as in reality, to the Christian experience, there's elements of the Old and New Testament which do give us instructions on when we are to speak comfortably unto Jerusalem. Isaiah 40, the first three verses, give us that instruction that when her warfare is ended, her 1845 years of without God's favor, from when Jesus cast them off in 33 AD until 1878, 1845 years later, Israel was restored to their homeland. Then Brother Russell and Bible students with him were speaking comfortably to the Jews to return to their homeland because now was their time for Israel to be restored. So there are scriptures that talk about it, but really not in the Revelation until we get to the peaceable kingdom. Did anyone have anything else on that particular question of Brother Michael? Israel's role in from the Revelation. Brother Michael, to you, any thoughts?
No, I'm just curious about it. But definitely the focus has been on the church. And when we look at Romans chapter 9 to 11, we know from what the Apostle Paul wrote there that a time of favor was going to come back to the nation of Israel so that we can have this privilege of knowing God, you know, so us being the Gentiles, you know, so... Well, I was just curious that, I mean, in all of this, there seems to be no indication whatsoever of the nation of Israel. And I think it probably aligned with the 1845 years of disfavor, you know, that, that coincides with the time when the church is going through its own turmoil, you know, and formative period. So I was just curious to just see if there was any particular thought from any of the brethren or even Brother Russell, because I haven't seen any, you know, on the new revelation.
Okay, thank you. And that's true. So the revelation, like we looked at today in Revelation, the 12th chapter, about the woman and being pregnant, and we started in 33 AD at Pentecost. And we started with our first of our seven heads with Constantine at that shortly thereafter in 313 AD, 300 years later, basically. But it's true. The key is that Israel as a nation went out of existence basically in 70 AD. So the church at Pentecost was developed 33 AD. By 70 AD, 37 years later, Israel, Jerusalem's burned, the temple's destroyed, and the people begin to be scattered. So throughout this long diaspora of the gospel age for Israel, that yeah, they are scattered. It's when Israel is regathered toward the latter end of the gospel age, during the seventh stage of the church, that now suddenly, once again, there is a message that the church can give to the natural Jew and Israel. And it's one of our signs of our Lord's return and being in the times of restitution beginning. And so it is a hallmark, but we can understand why the revelation didn't focus on that, because for most of the gospel age, Israel didn't exist as a nation. We find out about Israel more in the Old Testament, in the prophecies we studied in Ezekiel and elsewhere. Okay, well, not to take any more time from Revelation on that particular perspective. Coming back to the 17th chapter, are there any comments or questions so far on what we discussed today? So in our verse, I was going to ratchet ourselves to verse 14. Did anyone have anything they wanted to comment before that? 9 through 12 or 9 through 13? I think we've discussed it. Was there anything anyone wanted to add or ask? So let's read verse 14. Sister Cheryl, could you read for us Revelation 17:14, please?
These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are called and chosen and faithful. So we know ultimately the Lord will overcome. This message to the feet members. Thankfully, he's given us this wisdom, and we're privileged to be associated with him overcoming the powers that be over.
Okay, very good. Thank you. So, Brother Anil, in the notes on page 10, we've spent a lot of time talking about other scriptures on that hour of verse 12, but we've covered these in the past. So I was just going to let that go. They are in the notes if anyone cares to read more on that. Sister Cheryl's comments to this point, we wanted to take a look at perhaps a couple of scriptures. Let's see. Brother Mark, could you read for us Luke 12:32?
All right, here goes Luke 12:32. Do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father has chosen gladly to give you the kingdom. I think bringing that out probably because it's being brought out here in verse, was it 14, that they shall make, let's see, with the Lamb, they shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. And this is the Lamb and the church, I think, complete at that time. Over.
Okay, very good. And how big is the flock, Brother Mark, for emphasis?
144,000.
Okay, comparatively a little flock to Earth's millions.
Yes.
Okay, good. And then, Sister Roseanne, could you read for us, please, Matthew 22:14? Matthew 22:14.
Oops.
Yes, 22:14. For many are called, but few are chosen. And this goes back to the little flock, because, you know, God calls, but only few will, consecrate and come to God.
Okay. All right. Very good. So true. And then, let's see, Brother James, could you read for us Revelation 2:10? Revelation 2:10.
Revelation 2:10. Do not be afraid of what you're about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days, even to the point of death, and I will give you the crown of life.
Okay, your translation left out the word I was wanting. Doesn't mean it's not good. It's that the Bible students use the latter part of this verse as our encouragement one to another. Does that ring any bells?
The crown of life? I'm not sure.
Okay. Very good. Quite often from the podium, there'll be a banner or a representation of this crown of life and the cross. And then they quote part of this verse. What's that quote? Anyone?
Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life.
Yes, exactly. All right. So with that, we're taking these verses to just help us clarify that in Revelation 17, verse 14, we know who the Lamb is. That's our Lord. We know he's the Lord of lords and King of kings. But those that are with him, they were called. There's the high calling. They were chosen. That is, they were spirit begotten. And they were faithful. That is, they were faithful unto death. So this is the, many are called. A fewer number are spirit begotten, chosen. And out of that, although are spirit begotten, those who are faithful unto death would be of that little flock. So, so in Revelation, the 19th chapter, let's take a look there. Revelation 19. And, Brother Chris, could you read there for us Revelation 19 and verse Oh, let's say 11 through 16, please. 11 to 16.
And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war. His eyes were as a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns, and he had a name written that no man knew but he himself. And he was clothed with a vesture dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean. And out of his mouth goeth a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron. And he treadeth the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. And he hath on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings, Lord of Lords.
So, Brother Chris, can you connect this to our Revelation 17:14 for us, and then we'll close the study after that.
That is just speaking. This is really, of course, this is Jesus, Faithful and True, the only name known unto himself. That's interesting, and that has yet to be discussed in some detail, but he is the Word of God, the Logos, so we have this identification that he did have a pre-existing life, and that title will always be true. And the armies, that's the church, both sides of the veil, and they too have the white linen of righteousness that's imputed to them. Those on the other side of the veil already have it actually. Those on this side of the veil, we have it imputed. And out of his mouth, this is his spokesman. These are those on basically on this side of the veil, preaching and proclaiming the kingdom and the sword of truth. And it's going to smite the nations. They're not going to like it. And they'll be angry at first until they get with the general idea. And he's going to tread this winepress. The doctrines, the evil ones will be crushed. And the good ones will be pressed in, as it were. So it's going to be, you know, a winepress is a place of pressure. His vesture, his clothing. The blood, this life is squeezed out of the systems, that we're all familiar with. They will be destroyed. And so, and all we'll see on his thigh, because this is emblazoned as he's doing his action. You look and really you see that the horse and on his thigh is this King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So, this is God converting, taking over the earth and bringing in the righteous kingdom. Over.
Okay, very good. Thank you. So we see our connection link with our verse, chapter 17:14, the same King of Kings and Lord of Lords that gains the victory over the beast, the woman, and the 10 kings. And we see that here, like Brother Chris brought out, the armies, also on white horses, would represent the completed church with some in the flesh. So they will be the ones in our Revelation 17:14 that the beast has made war against, the church in the flesh. But the church in the flesh will defeat them with the truth, like as brought out. Okay. We have to close there, and Lord willing, we'll pick up with verse 15 next week, Revelation 17:15, and continue with these notes. And